Okay, welcome to the final presentation, marking our closing for the day. We've made it this far without anything bad happening, so hopefully with Adam's talk, nothing will go wrong. Adam.
Good afternoon. I'm really happy to have this talk, actually. It means I'm essentially the most eagerly anticipated talk of the entire conference because I'm the last one, and now you can all get sleep. My name is Adam. If you see me, I'm an IFC on the left, on CPAN in the middle, and in real life on the right. So I just wanted to say it's been really interesting to come here because for a bunch of geeks that are normally sitting at home on their computer, on IFC, it's been really cool to see everyone getting together in person, sitting on their computer, using IFC. Pretty much everybody has been doing it all day. In fact, some of them more extreme than others. But at least you can know that even the most social among us, the organizers, are still prey to the same problem. The other good thing about this conference talk has been talking to people with incredibly, incredibly smart brains and watching them describe things and invent things on the spot that you just blows your mind. Of course, of limited usability, because we don't know really how good the design was at the time he was telling me about my new firewall filter that I really need to work. So, I'm a Perl coder and have been for a long time. I got into Perl because I found something that HTML couldn't do. And at the time, CGI was all there was. After a couple of years, I found the CPAN, and then later on sort of decided that, well, this is the best way I can think of to write software, having this enormous repository of code that does 90% of everything you will ever need to do is the way to just get shit done. So after a while, you kind of think, well, look, there's always code. I wish I could contribute something. And it took me a couple of years, and I finally implemented what is essentially Java runtime class loading in Perl as my first attempt, because it was the only thing I could find that CPAN didn't have. Since that time, I've found that once you write your first one, it becomes a lot easier, and you tend to write a lot more modules. So last count, I think I have 141. I also do a bunch of other stuff in the Perl community. I'm on the modules mailing list. So I help officially approve or bless namespaces and help guide people where the code should be. I have CPAN super user rights, which fucking rocks. And I do a lot of toolchain develop stuff. So when it comes to things like automated testing and how all the installation stuff fits together, I do a lot of the design for the new stuff that's coming out. Eventually, apparently, I have to do the Perl 6 CPAN, which I'm not looking forward to. But and more recently, I accidentally started a movement to do a new type of Perl distribution for Windows, which works exactly the same as it does on Unix, called Strawberry Perl. You can see it at win32.perl.org. If anyone ever has to work on Windows and needs to use Perl and you come from Unix, use this, because it's exactly the same. CPAN works, compiled modules work, there's no PPM binary packages, everything is just the same. So, because I've been doing a lot of this work with projects and seeing all these projects come through, I've been starting to try and answer for myself the questions of how do you scale code bases up? So let's ignore throughput or memory size or all these things. Just how do you scale code bases up? Because a lot of people do it badly, and it really shouldn't have to be that way. People can learn these things, and yet they learn the basics of a language, go to do modules and large-scale code, and they all seem to fuck up in the same way. I think it's kind of because there is no textbooks for how to write big-scale code. I blame conferences, mostly, for this problem. I think that conferences are fundamentally flawed because people are learning these high-scale, really subtle things at conferences. You don't learn this stuff out of books. You come along to conferences and you talk to the coolest people you've ever met who have done all these huge things, and they tell you all these war stories about what not to do and what to do, and you learn stuff that way. But really, the structure of the conference itself is flawed because learning to do big things is very, very hard. You do things here, but the conferences themselves, the speakers giving talks are far too positive. Most of the speakers are just hyping their latest project, and you've probably seen 50% of the talks here today talking about some new cool project. Yeah, mine included. if you go particularly to more businessy type conferences, you'll hear these success stories. The business corpy types love success stories because they're stories of how people got things done. And there'll be a lot of speakers that will stand up and say, well, this is our way to do testing. Do it our way. These are dangerous. And of course, speakers that are entertaining. We've had a few of those as well. So conferences tend to have a major, major positive bias to them. They're always talking good and positive and rock, right? So this is important. It's wrong for a reason. It matters because the lead developers of tomorrow, the guys that are here, that are learning from the best, who are coming to the conferences, are being seduced into failure. They're seeing all these cool, shiny things, and they're going off and doing them, not really understanding how to do them properly. And they're being seduced into making critical mistakes. This is even more important because if you bear in mind that some of these mistakes can be so large that the amount of time required to deal with them downstream can be higher than your net worth as a human being. So a typical human will deliver about $7 or $8 million worth of useful work in their entire life. It is possible in some of these projects that you kick off to make mistakes so large that they invalidate you as a human being. So learning not to make mistakes is important. Something is missing from the conferences. Something I plan to, from now on, intend to fill. I'd like to come up and give you examples of what not to do. Failure stories. Why projects have failed. Which ponies will bite if you try and get them. And so on and so forth. I'd like to present to you the antidote to every other talk at this conference. I'm going to give you a series of problems that are well known from various areas, but programmers don't necessarily know. We have more engineer and university trained people, so you might have a bit better, more knowledge. But a lot of these are software scaling issues. Okay, so who knows the halting problem as a really common Okay, so you understand that if you have a subroutine and you want to write another subroutine that will work out how long it runs, it's impossible. You cannot write a function that will determine how long another arbitrary piece of code takes to run. Fine. However, that means that you don't know if it will ever stop in the lifetime of the universe. Thus, anything that executes even one arbitrary function anywhere is provably vulnerable to a denial of service attack. Mathematically provable. And that means things like plugins. If you automatically search for plugins, denial of service attack. Anywhere that can load encode, eval strings, you should all know. But anything that will result in some piece of code being executed, even if it's already pre-compiled and you don't control it, is provably a denial of service attack. You cannot stop it. All you can do is mitigate the damage. Now, unfortunately, there are a lot of editors that like to do compiling in the background, linting, essentially. Now, Komodo, for example, does Perl linting. It does Perl-C, blah, 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 and gives you nice squiggly underlines in the editor, which say, this is the piece of your code that's breaking, and this is the error message. Unfortunately, that means executing begin blocks, which means you can put anything you like into an editor without saving it, and it will execute it. Which, if I can convince you to load up rn-rf-tild, is very dangerous. Or even a while one. We can put an infinite loop in the begin block, put a little bit of anti-tainting in, and it will load. Which means that if you ever have file association in your operating system, and you download a piece of code from a website that happens to be hidden behind some sort of a redirector, I could put new version of Komodo is out on /dot and delete your home directory. Very, very bad to execute code you don't trust. This could be simply fixed, of course, by making the linty, backgroundy compiling stuff just not run at startup. You have to turn it on. But you have to take these things into account. Engineers, failure modes. Yeah? Oh, not enough engineers. The hardware-related guys will know this. Okay, so a failure mode describes how something will fail. It's a fundamental engineering principle where you speculate what will happen if something is going to fail, even if you think it's highly unlikely, unless you can prove it's impossible to fail. Then what you do is, regardless of the value of each of two or three solutions, you pick the one with the best failure, even if it's worse. So bicycle couriers understand this very, very much. Bicycle couriers under no circumstances will ever ride a bike that contains carbon fiber. Any engineers that come from more physical areas? What happens to carbon fiber when it breaks? Lots of nasty, evil splinters that will come off, go into your body, and move around on their own. Broken carbon fiber is extraordinarily dangerous. Bicycle couriers get into a lot of accidents. So no bicycle courier, even though it would be lighter and better and they might need to go faster, will ever use a carbon fiber bike. In fact, a lot of them won't even use the corporate ones where they're buying all the bikes for you, will only use metal. Even though they're heavy and slow, it means when you have a crash, they bend. Okay? This happens in software a lot. If there's two ways you could do things, and one will result in something exploding, and the other one will result in something being less optimized, pick the one that's less optimized, even if it's slower to start with. Copper gutters, the Americans went through a phase after World War II when they were like, well, we could have copper gutters and the water quality will be awesome. Unfortunately, copper conducts electricity. So when a house gets hit by lightning, it goes all around the gutters, into your pipes, and every single pipe and fitting and tap in your house simultaneously explodes. Copper gutters are very, very bad. It took them 10 or 20 years to learn this, but when every pipe in your house explodes simultaneously and you have to essentially pull the entire house down, you learn. Good for water quality, bad in failure cases. The ratchet problem. Anyone? No, no economists here. Economics is essentially engineering for psychologists. The ratchet problem is very, very simple. It suggests that people don't operate in ways like computers that are not predictable and reversible. They're non-linear. This is the ratchet problem. Once you do things, sometimes you can't go back. All right? Lots of things flow out from this. My favorite example is Israeli daycare centers, or at least one specific, from a very famous case where these guys in Israel, some economists, wanted to do an experiment on looking at how much punishment could change people's behavior. So they went to a daycare center. It's not what you think, honestly. So daycare centers, in general, have one major problem. No, hang on, sorry. Dirty minds! No. Daycare centers have childish people. Ha-ha. So, why is mommy late? Number one problem at daycare centers, parents don't turn up in time. Right? This leaves very crying children, and it makes you have to pay extra for the staff to keep them quiet. So, they took a daycare center, which had an existing fee structure of a $3 fine per day if you turned up late to pick up your child. And I said, well, let's push this really high and see what happens. Let's go not $3 a day, let's go $10 an hour. Unfortunately, the number of people turning up late went up. Because now it wasn't a bad thing. Now it was acceptable to come late per hour. And the daycare center overall cost meant that this was actually quite a reasonable amount. If I want to go shopping, well, look, it's 10 bucks an hour. I'll just go shopping and come back later. So the number of people late went up. So, well, that was an interesting effect. Okay, study over. So, okay, we'll put it back to the old rate now. So they put it back down to $3 a day. Unfortunately, it went up again. So now, not only was it acceptable to be late to get your child, it was cheap. Sometimes you can't go back, particularly with people. This means if you're going to do something which involves people, be very careful before you do it, because sometimes you can't fix the bug. The open problem. An open problem, in any problem with an unchanging scope, i.e. no clients, an open problem is something for which you don't control all of the factors. You can't nail down the entire problem into something you can solve. So, in a closed problem, the scope has very clear boundaries. You know what you have to solve. An open problem, it doesn't. So, implementing an RFC, in essence, is a closed problem. You have a spec, you write to the spec, it's done. An open problem is something like search the internet, which you really can't control and you can never really finish. So, damn clickers. In a closed problem, you write the code, you write the test, you write the documentation, and you're finished. In an open problem, you're going to have to keep working on it, essentially forever. Which means that in a closed problem, the cost of the solution trends to zero over time. Hands up anyone that has paid for libgzip or an equivalent simple compression library. Nobody. Because it's a closed problem, it implements the algorithm, it's solved. There is no value in this problem anymore. an open problem needs cash flow permanently. It needs resources to coming in, and whether this cash flow is just volunteers, it needs it forever. So good examples of solving closed problems are most of the libs that you see in a system. Libpng solves PNG. CPAN provides all these libraries to do all these simple things. Good example of solving an open problem is Google. If you want to do an open problem, go corporate. There's money. Likewise, open problems are very bad if they're your problem. If you want to do something that's internal to your company or organization and it's an open problem, avoid it at all costs. Conversely, if it's a client problem, open problems are very good because they'll have to keep paying you forever. Now, of course, you don't want to hide this, but if the client is open and accepting of it being an open problem and there is no other way, I have one client who has an open problem. He loves it. He loves it because he can do something nobody else can do. And I have exceptions in my code that generate me emails of the error pre-approved from the client to bill him to fix them. So my own code generates me billable hours. And I know it's reliable because it's an open problem. It can't be solved, you know, in a way that can be nailed down. I wish I had more. So one way of detecting an open problem that already exists is to look at where the highest bug concentrations are. So of all of CPAN, of all the bug counts in rt.cpan, these are the ones with the highest bug counts. Scrape the web is essentially this problem. Do asynchronous programming, the entire field. Do everything related to CGI, the entire field, in one module. Produce a binary package in Perl that can be run on any operating system. Open problem. So most of the places you find these bugs are going to be places where they're trying to solve something they shouldn't be solving, like the way they are. They should be compartmentalizing it. Next one, reality perception mismatch, or perception reality mismatch. If you write code for yourself, it is not like writing code for other people. When you write code for yourself, only whether the code works or not actually matters. If you're writing code for other people, the perception of your code matters as well. In fact, for publicly visible projects, the perception of your project is equally as important to the reality of the code. Some say more, that guy. So if you get it wrong, if you have bad perception and bad reality, okay, it's dead, it will be Darwinized. If you have good perception, good reality, you'll be successful. What happens is, the problem is inside. So you can have a really good perception, but really bad reality. You've overstretched yourself perception-wise. We call this stuff hype and vaporware. And if you start releasing stuff before the reality has caught up to the perception, you get all these users that you now have to support, and you'll have all these legacy users hanging around. It would be better to just ditch all the users and go without users, like enlightenment. Lasser's words, quote unquote. All right? He doesn't want users because they don't let him finish. He wants the code working properly before he gets lots of users. And that's his choice. And it's probably a good choice, even if it means that it might be a while. You can also lead to unrecoverably bad first impressions. It can lead you to people to look at things and never look at them again because they were shit. Release early, release often. Once it works. All right? If it doesn't work, don't release it. The flip side also happens. If you have a good reality but a bad perception, nothing could possibly go wrong with the slides, most of them you don't know. Most of these projects you've never even heard of. They're doing good things, but you don't know what they are. But I'll give you one example. Perl. The language is stable. There is nothing interesting left in the syntax of Perl. Nothing. And so where the cool stuff is in the module. And the CPAN keeps growing at an accelerating rate. We're now at 11,000 packages, adding it 2,000 or 3,000 packages a year. More cool stuff keeps getting done, but nobody knows about it because the syntax sucks compared to Ruby or Python or whatever. Which leads to this impression. Perl is dead. I actually like this. I think this is a good thing because it means there's this equal amount of work. It's still useful. Companies are still creating new projects in Perl just as fast as they were because you can still get the stuff done quickly. There's just less newbies coming up, which as a Perl consultant means lots of good things. Perl programmers get rarer. My rates go up. Long term, of course, it's a problem. When programmers start to get too expensive, you start moving to other languages that are cheaper. But, you know, if anyone knows a bit of Perl and doesn't like their job. Conflict of interest. Everyone should know. Heads up. Anyone? Yeah, okay. anyone that went to uni should have done this compulsorily. A conflict of interest is when you have to make a decision and your decision is not in the best interest of the people you are advertising yourself as from. Committees and such where you have other interests that conflict with what you're supposed to be making a decision on. It impacts judgment calls. My favourite bad example of conflict of interest is Korba. Now, Korba is designed by committee, so it's already in trouble. The body, rather than producing code, would produce standards. Unfortunately, they produced standards before code ever actually existed that implemented it. So instead of taking from the best stuff, they just created new standards. Half of Korba committee was major users, and half of the Korba committee was major vendors. So the users, of course, if they wanted a new feature, rather than ask the vendors and try and make them implement it, they just bully a new standard through committee. And then, of course, the vendors would have to implement it because it was a standard, right? So they would get their new features just by sort of saying, we want this feature, whether or not it actually worked. So they would produce incorrect standards that didn't work. Then, of course, the vendors had to implement the standards. So they would go and implement the wrong standards to the letter. So not only was the code wrong by design, it was being implemented directly to spec. So there are parts of Korba that are provably impossible to implement, but are contained in the spec. And you can understand now why Korba turned into an enormous mess and kind of died, right? Because it was so corrupted by these conflicts of interest. Everyone involved in the Korba standards board and all this stuff has essentially wasted their time because the committee was set up wrong. That's an example of a decision that could invalidate your entire life. Whoever set up the Korba committee, I don't know, but, you know, bad decision to set it up the way it was set up. And, of course, the vendors that hadn't implemented it first would stonewall the standards through until they had time to implement it. That's common on every standards body. The Korba body was particularly bad this way. A lot of standards, at least they're pulling from existing implementations. It's just companies fighting between themselves. That's not so bad because they've at least implemented it once. When you don't implement it at all, standards are bad. Ashton's problem. This one is kind of new, and I like it because I came up with it. So Ashton's problem is the inverse of Ashton's law, which I also came up with. Ashton's law is named after Elaine Ashton, a famous, infamous Pearl personality, who has sort of spotted a lot of things over the years, a long way ahead of the rest of us, but has been particularly blunt about the way she describes them, and so has not got the traction she should have. So Ashton's law says this: just make it fucking easy to install. Now, the odd thing about Ashton's law, of course, is it's expressed as a function. So every time you evaluate it, it changes slightly. So formalizing this, which has been done very recently, the ease of procurement of a piece of software is twice as important to the success and market share as whether the software actually works. PHP. PHP confused me for a long time, right? The countryside people will be iffy about PHP. What PHP does better than any other language in the world is the first hour is useful and easy. PHP comes installed on every web host. Every HTML editor can be used as a code editor. It gets people in. It lets them get something done. And merely by the fact that it is easy to procure, it is automatically much more successful than the more general languages. If you can implement this in your own code, it generally seems to work everywhere. Now, I don't have a graph, but the interesting part of this is anyone's done a bit of chemistry and knows about like optimizing reactions. For every hour you spend working on your code, to maximize the success, you should spend 2 hours working on the installer or getting a Debian package or a pre-bundle deal with Dell. Right? Making your code easy to install is twice as important, and you should spend twice as long on it if you just are interested in market share and success. So Ashton's problem is when you don't do this so fantastically that no one has even heard of you. Has anyone heard of Insurrection? Okay. Insurrection is the best subversion repository manager I have ever used. It is so ridiculously easy. It's not a web view thing. It's essentially a way of letting you manage users. Just put in an email address and forget it. And it does everything else. It mails them out, has password control, deals with all the permissions, lets you create multiple repositories, does all this magic stuff. Unfortunately, it is impossible to install. It not only uses XSLT in Apache, optionally, through different browsers, and has to integrate into the Apache config on its own, and does a whole bunch of other things, and it has to integrate with Subversion, the server side, and does a whole bunch of stuff. There are only 3 people I'm aware that have ever managed to install Insurrection. the author, the guy that managed to do it and told me how he did it, and when I failed, a friend of mine who is the best sysadmin I've ever met. I can't install it. I've had hardened sysadmins and developers, after they've seen this, because I've given them accounts, try to install it and come back and swear at me. Because they're pretty good, and yet they can't get it installed. Lots of swear. I don't even recommend it anymore, because it's just too much of a pain to install. God help the Debian packager. Perl's new build system has similar problems. It's meant to make installing things easier. Unfortunately, it doesn't bootstrap. So if you don't have it installed, and you have a dependency on it, CPAN will recurse down to module build and not have it, or to something that needs it, not have it, not recurse, and crash. This is extraordinarily bad for someone that tries to deal with the problems resulting from this. I didn't write it. I wish it kind of was written by, yeah. The Debianized version of RT. RT, until very recently, had a Debian package which was the most difficult Debian package I've ever seen. It involved going apt-get install RT, and then reading a 6-page README file, which starts with, the database you will be choosing to run RT on is very important. First, choose the database you'll be running, da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da. Steps you have to manually set the schema up, all the normal Debian stuff sort of stops at copying the file. Because the authors of RT didn't want to make the choice of Postgres or MySQL for you. They thought it was extremely important that you picked not only which database, but whether it will be CGI or ModPerl or ModPerl 2 or FastCGI. It is extremely important that the users pick that correct. But really, for most people, it's not. I think it has been fixed now. The tragedy of the commons. Anyone? Or at least knows the popular version? All right. Basically, common property will be destroyed, and there is nothing that you can do about it. By tragedy, it means in the Greek tragedy sense. It'll be gradual, but it is inevitable. If there is common property and everyone can walk on the grass will eventually be destroyed, which is why we have don't walk on the grass signs standing next to lush grass that looks like you should be able to walk on it. Because if they did let you walk on it, there wouldn't be grass. It would also get rid of the sign and make a lot of people happier, I guess. Fishing stocks is the classic example of this. It is extremely difficult to control where people fish, and so people tend to overfish habitually. You don't have common law across all these things. Wherever there is not common law and you have common property and you don't have a consistent way to uniformly control it, these things will eventually be destroyed. I have a lot of concern about fish stuff. I don't see an easy solution. The closest solution we have is like Australia, to have such a huge area under control that it's very difficult for anyone to exploit it properly. If anyone knows Perl, putting anything in the universal namespace, which is like something that will be in every object, is very bad. Don't change the way every object in the entire application works. This also applies in other languages, prototypes, and if anyone uses the JavaScript library, it overwrites objects. Sorry. Did I? Oh, what do you know? So the prototype JavaScript library does this. It overwrites objects. It puts extra keys into objects, which if you ever try and get a list of all the functions in a prototype, will then go and pull out extra stuff. And it tends to break code. Anything where you're putting things into common areas that will affect globally the way the application works causes strange actions at a distance. It's basically black magic. And we should all know what happens when you put too much black magic together. The first one works. The more magic you pile on, the much larger chance it is it will explode violently. Multi-author cooperative multitasking, i.e. Mac OS 9. Cooperative multitasking is actually what a lot of the asynchronous toolkits do, Twisted, Poe, etc. But the programs only come from one author. It's not a bad thing in this case. There is no conflict of interest or there's no common property to steal. You own the whole thing. If you have something like Mac OS 9 where different applications are trying to get their part of the OS, it will inevitably fail because you cannot hold back people from taking common property. Oh, and of course, the person that decided they would make their CPAN installation script phone home to their server. Of course, after we told her to stop, she said, well, no, I'll put something in front of it. So now it asks you if it can phone home. Except that, of course, could you imagine if in a recursive install of 100 modules, every single module stops for 30 seconds and says, can I call home? Next recursion, can I call home? You would be pulling your hair out. It doesn't work. It only works because one person or two people use it and nobody uses their module. Mostly. Interestingly, the corollary of this is also true, the tragedy of the anti-commons. If you have ownership, you can have ownership so tightly that it obstructs and destroys the very thing that you're trying to protect. For example, the post-USSR commercial real estate market. They had a situation in which after it broke up, one group would have control of the rent, another group the gas, another group the water, and they all had prices and conditions and wouldn't budge. This resulted in a situation where you would have entire districts of the commercial area with no shops at all other than McDonald's. And out on the street, incredibly vibrant, bustling street vendors. Because you could have a street vending store without having to worry about all these obstructive owners. And it was damaging the area. It wasn't until they loosened up a bit and let people move in more and were more flexible about controlling these things that they actually managed to get back to a normal commercial situation. Private beaches, I'm not in America, so this one doesn't hit quite as hard, but I honestly, it obstructs something. It really does. It's ownership that takes things away from everybody. It's basically exploiting. Ultimately, it causes nothing but problems. The American implementation of copyrights and patents, the Australian one, not so bad. The American version of copyrights and patents allows ownership so obstructive that, as RMS would say, you cannot write any program without violating patents, and leads to this situation where you just try to ignore them. The Australian implementation, not quite so harsh. Their standards of novelty seem to be higher. There aren't as many bad fallouts from Australian copyrights and patents as there are from the US. We've got it, and to be honest, it actually seems much more sane. It's built on a different set of laws, so it doesn't have the same fallout. It's not as obstructive. Yeah, we haven't seen people exploiting it yet. So. Yeah, I mean, I could be wrong. I suspect the Australian version of the DMCA will not be anything like the problems there are in the US. I have some level of faith in the sanity of Australians. Or at least their dislike of large corporations, anyway. Reclusive CPAN authors cause me no amount of headache. CPAN has a system where if your code goes stale and bit rots, other developers can take it over. That's what super user permissions are for. Fixing problems of ownership so we have continuity forever. Reclusive CPAN authors, and there are a few, don't want you to change their code, don't want you to take it over, but won't release code themselves. Very, very bad. It means stuff bit rots and can't be fixed. And something, even if it was heavily used, we don't have the ability to forcefully take it off it. CPAN assigns essentially property rights, or at least pseudo property rights. And abandoned freeware programs, my favorite music player of all time, which had the slogan, sound quality is not skinnable. Had a hacked up MP3 program, the guy just abandoned it. All this great software that disappeared because it wasn't open source. If you are writing something, I mean, okay, talking to the choir, right? So, now, where this gets even more powerful if you're actually doing design is that you can dial this property between freedom and ownership. Some situations require freedom, some require ownership. If you can control this on the fly, you can start very free and then gradually ratchet it back as you start to get problems of tragedy of the commons types, right? Wikipedia does this extremely well. People flag them off for locking down articles, but they're doing exactly this the right way. They keep things as open as possible, as long as they have to, and then slowly dial the ownership back as they start to hit actual trouble. Likewise, CPAN gives you complete property rights by default, unless we really need it, in which case we dial it back and take things off you a bit. If we had legal property rights on CPAN, it wouldn't work. The trust problem, which is very simple. Trust is a problem. Now, this may seem kind of counterintuitive, but if you have no trust, you have freedom. The reason this works is like this. If we have A and B, now this could be two different computers, two different companies, two different pieces of code in the one program, it doesn't matter. These things have to move things between them, but they're written by different authors, or they have different people in control, and can't trust each other. Now, if you can't trust each other, you can't necessarily do everything. There are some situations in which you really can't trust this code to be used. So what you end up with is a solution that's only partially useful. It only works in some cases. If you have a trust barrier so that you confirm things through, now your code is useful in 100% of cases because you can use it not just in the 99% of the situations in which it's okay to trust, but also in the 1% where you can't trust. So you have now got code that is universally useful, and stuff that is universally useful tends to be the stuff that hangs around. XML, For everyone that hates it, could we have a love versus hate? Love XML, Java programmers. Hate XML, Python, Ruby, Perl, everything else. Okay, so I'm generalizing, right? Okay, but XML was designed for moving data between disparate systems, between different areas of trust. The most useful thing in XML are XML schemas. Schemas are what implement the trust barrier. That means you can pass data to someone and they don't have to care who you are. It just works. They don't have to write all this extra crazy shit. They can use it 100% of the time if you use schemas. So, leading from this, we end up with the Perl community's use of when should I use XML? When does it not suck? If you don't need a schema, you don't need XML. If you do need a schema, you do need XML. If you write only one thing down on your laptops other than IRC, write that down, because it gives you pretty much a universal solution to when should you use XML. It seems to work. Config files, unless you need to pass your config file to a disparate system over the internet, then you don't need XML. If you're ever talking to someone else and you're using XML, you must implement a schema. That is, unless I have spare time, is that, no, I've ran out of time, cool. I've actually got more, but it's like a tunable talk where nothing can possibly go wrong. Questions? Stunned. Okay. Non-biological evolution. This is why I keep this for after the questions. There is an area of evolution research which is called non-biological evolution. Now, a lot of people that have studied biological evolution will say, well, look, there is no ideal state. There is no journey. We're just changing to what adapts us. It appears from early research that there is a direction to evolution. And this is how it works. We think. The most evolved form is the form which can process the most information with the highest energy density in the least amount of space. Theoretically, at least, this will allow you to compare the evolutionness of a human versus the sun. Two completely different things. The human brain processes more information and generates more energy per cubic centimeter than the sun. Thus, humans are more evolved than the sun. Now, interestingly, we can apply this to code as well. If it's right, we can apply this to code as well. It means that if you can solve a problem and get the most work done in the least amount of memory, which is all we really have in terms of space, and the least amount of code, you are the most evolved form. Over time, you'll win. Lib packages, which are written in C and are well written and extremely small, are the ultimate expression of software. Over time. Except for things like functional programming. It turns out that things like Haskell can actually implement the same functionality in even smaller space by doing carrying and sucking out entire sections of code that aren't applicable. So in some cases where Haskell can do something or similar functional languages in an even smaller space and be provable down to the math, we have an even better solution. So to make a wild prediction, my prediction is in the next 5 or 10 years, you are going to see a lot more functional programming stuff appear and try to be made usable. This is where I promote Perl 6. Because Perl 6 implements functional programming idioms. And of course, the Highlander problem. Bingo! There can only be one. If you ever try to write, this is how I wasted 2 years of my life. And there are no more slides, because what I did was come up with a code generation system. I tried to solve the problem between code gen that you run just once and code gen that you can run over and over and over again, but only from a model. I tried to solve the problem of merging the two and succeeded. However, there can only be one code gen system. I can't actually make copies of it because it self-evolves over time and the APIs move as it learns stuff from the old project. So unfortunately, while I have something I can use to make programs for myself, I can never sell it to anyone else unless I giant Skynet-y thing. Because if you have two versions, If I were to make a copy and install it somewhere else, and two people did two different types of projects on it, it would suck in the code from those projects, and the code bases would immediately diverge in different directions. So it took me 2 years of coding and 60, 70,000 lines of code to make a working system that I can only use myself. So while it kind of works, it's not a good solution long term. It just simply won't work. So it's doable to solve those problems, but not in a way that is actually viable in any large-scale way. And that pretty much covers it. Yeah. Oh, a question. Yeah.
Something has to go wrong.
Yeah, exactly.
So does this mean we're going to get Perl 6 in the next 5 to 10 years?
Can you answer that question in less than 5 seconds?
Shut your laptops, I'll tell you. I don't want any permanent record. All right, so about June last year, the tentative don't hold us to this call, right, Christmas, was Alpha, Christmas 2006, Beta, 2007, Production, 2008, Christmas. We're slightly late on the Alpha. But if you don't hold me to this and don't hold Larry to this, it is looking roughly that that will be the way. Sometime in the next weeks, slash months, by weeks I mean like 7 or less, so that it's not months, there should be an Alpha of Perl 6 coming out sometime real soon now. And it will be installable and muck around. I mean, you can use it now. Pugs work, but it's a bit iffy to install, right? Not very successful. Alphas will be coming real soon now. And then beta, maybe the end of the year. And then we'll start to see the ramp up for production releases quite soon. So, yeah, it's not... Until 2 years ago, I would have told you that it would never come. Until Audrey Tang created Pugs using Haskell functional language and implemented a Perl 6 expression parser in 6 days, had a first working implementation of Perl 6 in 6 days. And until that happened, I would have said, yeah, it was just a nightmare and it was never going to come. It's looking pretty close now. And the number of commits keeps getting higher and higher and higher. So, I mean, you can use it now and it will work now. Most of everything works except for things like unions, which because they're meant to work quantumly, have some issues with threading. You can't do them all at the same time. But no, it's getting close. Perl 6 is one that has suffered from the unrecoverably bad first impressions. It went out too early, it went out too loud, and it suffered for it. But it's close. I think we're going to start seeing real stuff. Sorry? Following the Debian release schedule. Yeah. It's going to come, and it will be real. It's just sometimes it takes a while to do it properly, which is why I use Debian and not Ubuntu.
Well, I think on that scoop, we'll close it. If we can all thank Adam for his talk. And now if you can all get out of here so we can clean this up before we get to the dinner tonight.